The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Crushing defeat. The Commons finally has its say on Theresa May's deal. Hard border? What hard border? Arlene Foster's selective memory. And worst case scenario, Ireland prepares for a crash out Brexit. All that and more in tonight's Late Debate. But first the news with Eileen Whelan. Thanks, Eileen. Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Katie Hannan. Joining us tonight, we have Deputy James Lawless of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael Senator Neil Richmond, Sinn Féin Senator Rose Conway-Walsh, John McGrane, Director General of the British-Irish Chamber of Commerce, and Niamh Lyons, Political Editor of the Times Ireland Edition. Now, we want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_rte. Well, Theresa May finally had to face the music today with the speculation in advance of the vote, not on whether she would win, but on how many votes she would lose by. But few would have predicted the scale of the loss by 230 votes, the biggest ever defeat for a British government.
The House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how. Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold.
The government has lost the confidence of this House and this country. I therefore, Mr. Speaker, inform you I have now tabled a motion of no confidence in this government. And I'm pleased that motion will be debated tomorrow so this House can give its verdict on the sheer incompetence of this government and pass that motion of no confidence in the government.
Now, John Rentoul, Chief Political Commentator of the London Independent, is on the line. John, an extraordinary evening in the Commons.
Yes, I mean, that was history in the making. We didn't expect the defeat to be quite as big as this. I mean, we knew the government would lose. We sort of assumed that loyalty would kick in at the last minute and that some Tory MPs would hold back from the brink, but actually it went the other way. We ended up with the chairman of the backbench 1922 committee, the leader of the Tory backbenches, Graham Brady. He voted against the government as well. So absolutely huge defeat for Theresa May.
Yeah, and we should tell listeners, of course, you've had a long day there in the Commons and you're still out and about, and that's we can hear that in the wind in the background there. The scale of the revolt actually from the backbenches was really stunning, wasn't it? Just 18 backbenchers voting with Theresa May this evening and 118 voting against her. I mean, isn't it really a mark of the dysfunction of British politics at this juncture that Mrs. May is able to carry on regardless in the face of that sort of a defeat?
It is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the fact that her party moved against her as leader last month, and a substantial number of MPs, in fact, almost exactly the same number of MPs voted against her, 117 in December, a third of her party. Yet they couldn't bring themselves to get rid of her because both sides of the party fear that someone from the other wing of the party taking over would be worse than she would be. So we're sort of paralysed in British politics, and we're paralysed by the three-way division in the House of Commons between advocates of leaving without a deal, leaving with her deal, and going for a referendum instead. None of those commands a majority, as she said. It is a special position. It looks worse than it is, in a sense, but it doesn't mean it's any easier to resolve the three-way deadlock.
And looking at that three-way deadlock, I mean, as you're reading it this evening, what does this vote and the scale of the defeat for this option, what does it bring us closer to? Are we moving closer to a Norway softer Brexit? Are we moving closer to a crashing out Brexit? What's the feeling in the Commons this evening?
I don't think so. I don't think any of those options has really shifted very much. I mean, there were a few more votes for a no deal Brexit. You know, that was most of the Tory party voting. And most of the Tories who were rebelling would rather have that, but there were 11 Conservative MPs who would prefer to have a referendum. They voted against her too. So she was caught in this pincer movement from both sides. But I think she was absolutely right. There are only two real possibilities that might gain a majority in the House of Commons, and that is her deal or a referendum. And yet the legal default, if the House of Commons can't agree, is to leave without a deal. So there are those three options in play, and we're no nearer to resolving that contradiction.
And let's talk about Jeremy Corbyn now. He laid down that confidence motion this evening. There's nobody believes, obviously, that he'll have the numbers to defeat the government or bring down Theresa May on that. But no sense either that Jeremy Corbyn is moving his party any closer to that position of supporting a people's vote, is there?
No, I think that was the significant thing that didn't happen tonight, was that he emphasised that Parliament had overwhelmingly voted to respect the result of the referendum. Now, that did not sound to me like a man who's preparing, if he can't win the vote of confidence, which he can't because the DUP came out within minutes of the vote and said they would support the government. It didn't sound like he was preparing, if he doesn't win that vote, to shift the Labour Party to a position of supporting the referendum, which you could say means that in the end it may be more likely that there's a majority in the House of Commons for Theresa May's deal, which sounds like an extraordinary thing to say after it's just lost such a huge margin.
Would you stay with us for one moment, John? Because I want to put this to Neil Richmond, who's on our panel here. Neil, where do you think this has brought us? Have we edged one way or the other closer to an option after tonight?
We've edged very much closer to the 29th of March, with absolute confusion still reigning within London. And ultimately, it is now for the British government and the House of Commons. The House of Commons have always said this is when Parliament becomes sovereign by this vote. They probably have done so. Now it's up to them to come back and say what exactly they want. And this is something that has dogged this entire process since long before the referendum itself. What Brexit meant, what Leave meant, was never spelled out. It was only when we came to July of last year and we had the Chequers, the par Chequers declaration, that we got some way towards it. However, we are in a situation now that we have to protect the absolute principles of the withdrawal agreement, particularly when it comes to the border on the island of Ireland, particularly when it comes to protecting the single market. But we will listen and react to what comes out of Westminster. There's a big day tomorrow, obviously, with a confidence motion, and going by what the Prime Minister has said, depending on that result, we'll see what Westminster says then.
John, watching that scene all around Westminster this evening, is there a growing a sense that, you know, were there to be a move towards a people's vote, a revoking of Article 50 or some kind of a delay, that there could be a response on the streets of maybe, if not London, some of the northern cities who have voted to leave?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, the idea that people would take to the streets, I think there would be, it would cause problems with British politics. It would cause bitterness and anger and a feeling betrayal. But I mean, I think it would be irresponsible to suggest that people are about to take to the streets and riot. I mean, I just don't think that doesn't come across at all. I mean, the demonstration outside the House of Commons today was very good-natured, broadly. I mean, there have been some ugly scenes in recent weeks of intimidation and abuse, but, you know, I think that's a minority. I think you know, one side or the other is going to be bitterly disappointed, and it will scar British politics for a long time. I mean, I just don't think you can suggest that it's going to get that bad.
Okay, John, I'll let you go. We will no doubt be talking to you very soon again. Thank you for bringing us that update this evening. I'll go back to my panel now. Rose Conway-Walsh, Where do you think this has left us this evening? And were you surprised at the scale of the defeat?
I think everybody was slightly surprised, yeah. I thought maybe kind of the last minute people. Like, if we look at this deal, it's the least worst option, if you like. It's not something like we supported the deal, and as a party we support the deal, but not because we think it's a wonderful thing, but because we don't want a hard Brexit. Where it leaves us now, it leaves us nearer to the possibility of a hard Brexit. And I think that's where we need to be at. And the Irish government need to stand very firm in looking after the interests of people right across this island. And I think that's the expectation of them. They cannot get involved in the British mess, if you like. That is a British mess, and it's up to the British to sort it themselves. I was glad to see, you know, the EU coming out tonight as well, saying we have to hold the backstop and we have to hold firm where we are. And the British have to make up their mind what they want right across the board, whether that be Labour or Tories or whoever else.
James Lawless, we saw that statement from Donald Tusk, just to remind people who maybe haven't seen it yet, telling us that the EU27 will remain united and responsible as we have been throughout the entire process, and we will seek to reduce the damage caused by Brexit, but also saying that the risk of a disorderly exit has increased with this vote. Would you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, I think he also said, he made a comment along the lines that the deal that has been proposed can't get through. No other deal seems to be acceptable. Who has the courage to actually call it out? So I think there's a suggestion that he was alluding to, you know, is it too late to stay in? I think put simply, yes, it is. But I suppose that has always been held out. How might that happen? I was listening to Sadiq Khan before I came out this evening, the Mayor of London, and he made a point which I think is very relevant as well. Why was the Article 50 triggered in the first place? Why did they start the clock running before they'd even planned any of this stuff? I mean, you could go back and say, why do they call the referendum? But, you know, bygones. But in terms of where they go next, the options on the table... A general election, I don't think is a real option. I know Jeremy Corbyn has tried to pull the trigger on that. I think it's very unlikely he's going to succeed tomorrow. But even if he did, even say with Tory rebels would ever mind it to give him support, where does that really get them? That's probably a month wasted. You know, we're is it 73 days away from D-Day? The people's vote, you know, being honest, you know, as someone who believes that the UK should remain and would like to see that happen, and we'd be better for Ireland, we think better for the UK, better for Europe. Even with that, I'm not convinced. I think if this has taught us anything, something as complex and as deep as this, is a single binary referendum vote the way to solve it? I'm not convinced that it is. So where do we go next? And I think maybe the only kind of path forward that I can kind of map out in my own mind and see, you know, maybe some semblance of a silver lining is if on the back of tonight's defeat, if the May government engages with the maybe more pragmatic members of the Labour Party, and maybe any Lib Dems and whoever else might be in the mix, but particularly Labour because they've got the numbers, and begin to plough a middle furrow, because maybe there's a basis of some kind of softer Brexit or some kind of, you know, I think the withdrawal deal is the withdrawal deal. There's nothing else on the table. But I think there might be, and I believe there was a breakdown in the UK cabinet this morning, the Met at lunchtime, and some of the maybe more pragmatic members were pushing that, saying, look, why don't we talk to Labour? You know, not Corbyn, because Corbyn is at heart a leaver, you know. He wants to nationalise the industries. He wants to kind of winter discontent that would run for years, that he can go and, you know, and have some kind of socialist nirvana. That's not going to happen. But maybe some of the more middle ground, you know, the Hillary Benz, and, you know, there's other good thinking Labour folk that might be persuaded to come around and maybe get a middle path.
Niamh, what about that Hillary Benz proposal that the next move now should be to put a series of proposals to the Commons and just see what can command at least some
I think that's the most obvious place to go now. I mean, I actually think this could be better for Ireland in particular. I think this could lead to a softer Brexit. I mean, there's no clarity whatsoever from that vote this evening. But an interesting one about the only amendment that was taken before the vote proper was from Conservative MP John Barron, who called for the UK to take unilateral powers to leave the backstop. Mm. Only 24 people supported that.
So again, though, isn't it very risky to read anything serious into
the hardest of hard Brexiteers isn't supported? And obviously this deal, which, as we know, best deal on the table, negotiated over 2 years, isn't supported. So now are we looking at... I think that's... The Taoiseach has actually been saying this for a while in sort of a more coded way, but It's what's been coming from the EU leaders too, and Guy Verhofstadt said it this evening in a tweet as well. We know what you don't want. Tell us now what you want. And I think, like, you know,
I must have retweeted you.
Yeah. A sort of an EEA plus customs union is something that apparently could get support.
This is the Norway plus.
Yeah. Something that I thought came up a good bit when I was watching the post-coverage vote, when there were people being interviewed outside the Commons tonight, was the idea that a citizens' assembly could be the way to go with this. And that sort of goes back to what James was saying. I really don't think there's any hunger out there for a second referendum. It's far too divisive. The question is too binary to be answered in this way. And it just throws up a lot of... I honestly think we'd be back to the NHS bus and the same old arguments if it was held again.
I just want to let John McGrain in. You've been sitting there patiently, John.
Yeah, well,
would you agree with that? That a people's vote could be a very risky adventure?
Well, there's little compelling evidence that I see so far that tells you that there's been a very significant swing enough to bank on from a political point of view. And it's very interesting that even those who are in favour of Ref 2 are quite guarded as to whether the timing is right, and that's before you get to all the constitutional stuff about so what question, how many questions, how long does it take to actually put that through the constitutional process. Most estimates say that's at least 9 months away. So this is about process, and the one thing Mrs May does understand is process. In fact, she may not reach
maybe a bit too much process
that, but maybe when all around you is chaotic and everybody wants something different, process is the one anchor that maybe is you can hold on to and you can guide the process with. And right now the process has delivered an outcome that from a business point of view is disastrous. It just compounds more uncertainty on the process for the hundreds of thousands of businesses and the millions of employees on both islands that are now no more certain about what happens in as little as 10 weeks. So the process takes us out to Monday, and I wouldn't underestimate the amount of groundwork that will be done across the corridors, as people now see, to say the one thing that the House did not want to have is a no deal. Clearly nobody knows how do you get to that, because that's the default, but there's a significant amount of, dare I say, goodwill in the House to say how do we avoid this no deal thing. And I'd watch very carefully. I mean, Tánaiste Coveney came out tonight and talked about patience, and people need to give politicians and the political process a patient space over the next number of hours and days till we see what the process throws up. If by Monday we're no better off, and we haven't been much better off at all the milestones so far, then business gets really alarmed indeed.
What about the calls, and there's been many calls over the last number of days and this evening again, to take no deal off the table? That if it's the majority in the Commons all believe that no deal would be a disaster, and this is one thing that does command a majority, to take it off the table. But that would present a real difficulty for Theresa May, wouldn't it? Because she would lose her negotiating card then, wouldn't she?
Yeah, and it was very interesting. I think it was yesterday, the day before. Only 12 MPs could bring themselves, Conservative MPs, to sign a letter calling for a no deal. Like, that was even less that voted for the one amendment that was voted upon tonight before the actual vote. I think definitely in the last couple of weeks we've seen the prospect of a no deal politically shift for sure, and JP Morgan have been quite blunt to that in their probabilities. However, as everyone keeps saying, the worrying thing, it is the default situation, and until we actually hear from Westminster of what they want, and indeed if they have to come back to the European Union with something that is at least kind of acceptable or takes into sheer account the European commitment both to the Good Friday Agreement and protecting the single market. Because what we've seen repeatedly is that just because the debate is held in Westminster or indeed at Chequers doesn't mean that's the end of it. There has been a gross ignorance within the Westminster bubble of the fact that this is a negotiation with the world's largest economic bloc. 27 other member states who have their own red lines and their own economy, and whilst we're very, very exposed, the most exposed EU member state, maybe then the Dutch and the Danes, the rest of the European Union are getting very fed up with this. They don't know why it wasn't sorted last summer. They aren't as exposed to Brexit as we are, and their patience, and we saw it with the Luxembourg Prime Minister before Christmas, is wearing very thin.
I did see reporting on Channel 4 News this evening suggesting that some German MEPs saying that maybe they should have left that whole border issue as a bilateral thing to be sorted out between UK and Ireland, maybe regretting that it had become such a centrepiece of
this the is something that we've process. Seen quite a bit of over the last 6 weeks, and we saw it actually yesterday morning in the British edition of The Sun, where Tom Newton Dunn once again reported an unnamed German official saying that we've invested too much into the border on the island of Ireland, but yet Angela Merkel, in the very first 10 minutes of her press conference yesterday, completely stood exactly firmly behind the backstop and the withdrawal agreement.
Believe the people are actually saying this, or that they're saying but they're not willing to put their names?
In some cases, I don't think people are saying it. And I think it's very easy to say unnamed European officials. And who is that? Is that a stagiaire in DJ Sante, or is it the Chancellor of Germany? And we have to be there. What is on the record and what has been consistent is absolute European solidarity behind the Irish position.
OK, I think we'll take a break there because I want to come back and go talk about what Arlene Foster said earlier today.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. You're listening to The Late Debate with me, Katie Hannan. And with me here in Studio 10 are Deputy James Lawless of Fianna Fáil, Senator Neil Richmond of Fine Gael, Senator Rose Conway-Walsh of Sinn Féin, John McGrain, Director General of the British Irish Chamber of Commerce, and Niamh Lyons, Political Editor of the Times Ireland Edition. Well, earlier today, at a press conference in advance of that Commons vote, DUP leader Arlene Foster spoke about her memories of growing up in Northern Ireland.
You know, as someone who lived through the Troubles, we never had a hard border. There were 20,000 soldiers in Northern Ireland, and they couldn't hermetically seal the border in Northern Ireland. So it is a bit of a nonsense, frankly, to talk about a hard border.
The Irish border Twitter account that many of us are following throughout this Brexit responded to these comments by Arlene Foster earlier by tweeting, "Brexit is now so weird that the leader of the DUP is gaslighting the Troubles."
Mm.
Rose, what did you make of those comments by Arlene today?
Well, I think it's ludicrous, and it shows how detached she is. You know, from people in the north. I mean, we've seen that already in the way that she's turned her back against business, against farmers, against people who will be deeply affected by this whole Brexit situation. But to dismiss the fact and say there was no border in the north.
To Arlene Foster, was she just not pointing out that it was a rather porous border in many respects?
Well, she should have said that then. I mean, she explicitly said that there was no border, you know, and made some kind of a flippant remark about there only being 20,000 soldiers there. You know, I think that speaks for itself. And I think, you know, I heard Sammy Wilson on tonight as well, as if this was some kind of a victory. Mm. You know, they have voted and they campaigned for Brexit from day one against the interests of people who vote for them.
John, you want... James?
It sounds to me, as actually just listen to that clip, what she means is the border wasn't hard enough for her. She would have preferred a Trumpian wall built right along the border. She probably still would like to see that happen. I crossed the border as a child. You know, I just have memories of it during the Troubles, going up on family holidays, up the Giant's Causeway, etc. There was a very hard border. There was barbed wire, there was military installations, there was walls at the checkpoints, there were soldiers with rifles, you know, standing in front of the car, talking to my mother, interrogating her, you know, or questioning her as we came across. With camps and in the back of the boot. So it was, you know, and anybody, you know, people who live there know that I have a lot better than I do. So I think this is ludicrous, this kind of suggestion. I believe she's also talking about technological solutions, you know, could be advanced. I mean, these mythical, you know, and it's another of the Brexit unicorns. You know, where in the world are these great technological solutions? Mm. After 2.5 years of the best minds of British industry, why haven't they figured them out?
Well, we do use some of that already, and say if you look at the likes of the type of trade that's done between Sweden, Finland, Denmark, that type of thing happens.
But crossed from Sweden to Denmark, and you have Sweden and Denmark are both members of the EU. I was at a conference in Copenhagen a few years ago. You actually, the bus on the bridge across the strait actually stops. You have to get off. You've got to show your papers, show your pass, to have a uniform check, and get back on again. And that's actually quite a porous border within the EU. So the idea we can do some kind of magic trick, you know, for a border that's outside the EU is just off the
wall. And the key one is the Sweden-Norway border, which is the example often used. Swedish-Norwegian border only has 60 crossings, and only 12 of those can be customs crossings, and half of those 12 then close at 10 o'clock at night. We've seen the official estimation of 208 crossings along a 499 kilometre border
in Ireland. It's completely incomparable to use the Norwegian model or the Swiss model, and the last one being put by the ERG was in Rwanda.
Well, I think the unfortunate thing now is that, I mean, judging from the statement that she sent out earlier tonight, is that Arlene Foster will be emboldened by what happened tonight in the Commons. And, you know, Theresa May made very brief remarks after the vote took place, but what she did say was, if I win my vote of confidence, which she's expected to, she's going to go into talks with people, but she's asking them to deal within the art of what is possible. But the fear is that Arlene Foster, and accompanied by the 10 DUP MPs, go in and start saying, right, well, this is your mandate now to get rid of the backstop. It's not. But I suppose that's when they start eyeballing Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney again. I mean, this was always the fear. And it was a kind of a genius move for the former Taoiseach Enda Kenny to get the Irish issue on the agenda first and foremost. I think people are worn out listening to it. But there could never have been a bilateral deal between us and the UK, because it will be nothing to do with the UK if we have to put a border up. It'll be the EU's decision.
I mean, what it brings into contrast again is or into sharp focus, is the unique position of the island of Ireland. And from a trading point of view, like what Ms. Foster didn't talk about today is the fact that, like, pretty well all of the businesses and now pretty well all of the farming community in Northern Ireland, who make up most of the employment and therefore the community well-being that really best promotes peace and stability in Northern Ireland, are all in favour of a deal, of accepting the withdrawal agreement and moving on to a transition phase.
Now, can we say that with that level of confidence? Well, I'm sure there is still some support on the ground for the DUP.
I've no doubt about that, Katie, but the point is that the organised representative voices, which, to be fair, in many cases have been a long time coming, but they are unequivocal now. In recent months, Northern Ireland's four, if not five, main business organisations and their farming representation has come out in favour of not crashing out, as is the main potential bugbear right now. And they know, hard or not hard, they know what it means to them to have restricted trade across the border in whatever way it's walled or not walled in this island. And from a political point of view, it's actually extremely important that that argument remains in the spotlight. And taking the point from earlier on, that the other 26 EU members absolutely acknowledge that. So whatever about Ms. Foster misremembering something about a former border in the past, the people in Northern Ireland are very clearly in favour of remaining, and business does not want any form of border to inhibit trade.
Okay, well, let's get the view from the pro-Brexit side of this argument now. Let's ask Mark Reckless, former UKIP and Tory MP and now a member of the Welsh Assembly, who is joining us on the line. Mark, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening.
If you want to comment there on what our panel were saying about our border situation.
Well, we either drop the backstop or we leave in 75 days without a deal. And I think it is possible to have an amicable agreement, but if Ireland or the end of the EU say to the UK that you can only leave with an agreement if Northern Ireland stays part of the EU single market, and if you're not allowed to leave the customs union without our permission in future, then the British Parliament has turned that down by a majority of 230. So either you drop that or we leave without a deal.
Do you really think, given what we've seen play out over the recent times, given the statements that have come out from Brussels this evening, that there is any realistic possibility that the EU will dilute the backstop?
Well, I think that's your call, really. I mean, I think it's Leo Varadkar.
I'm asking Mark for your analysis of where this might go. Do you genuinely believe that there is any movement still left in terms of that backstop?
Well, I think if Ireland asks the European Union to drop the backstop, the EU will change the withdrawal agreement to drop the backstop. If you don't, we'll leave without a deal in 75 days. There'll be another steep decline in sterling, there'll potentially be tariffs, and that'll be a very difficult situation because we won't have any agreements on issues such as how to deal with the border, which with goodwill on both sides, I think we can do very sensibly. I think that should be part of the discussions and negotiations on a future relationship. We should agree things we can now on citizens' rights, on the UK paying some money, on a period of transition, and then we should get on with negotiation in the future relationship rather than telling the UK that we can't leave with an agreement unless we agree to Northern Ireland staying staying in the EU single market and are only being allowed to leave the customs union with the EU's permission. I mean, that's completely unacceptable to the British Parliament, as you've seen tonight.
And what about the little matter of the Good Friday Agreement, Mark?
Well, the Good Friday Agreement says that we shouldn't make changes without consent, and the Irish Republic voted by an overwhelming majority to remove from your constitution the territorial claim to Northern Ireland. And I think it's wrong to exploit the Brexit process to try and...
Mark, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to intervene here. Mark, you are grossly misrepresenting the Irish government.
Sorry, Mark,
position.
This is Neil Richmond from the panel wants to put something to
Mark,
you.
Mark, good evening to you. I'm sorry, Mark, the British government is a co-guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement. They have a legal responsibility to make sure that no hard border goes across the island of Ireland that can pose a threat to
that
agreement.
Where in the agreement does it say that? Where does it mention the border?
Well, it mentions a material change to the situation on the island of Ireland that could bring back a troubles. I don't know if, when you're making out that somehow that the backstop is an Irish creation, the backstop is a response to the red lines presented by Theresa May and her government in the December 2017 political agreement. The backstop is equally owned by the British government as it is the European negotiating side, trying to drum up that this it's the phantom issue, that's the backstop alone. And this whole thing that we're trying to keep Northern Ireland, break it away from the United Kingdom, and that it's some sort of territorial assault is actually grossly offensive at this stage. And I'd have to question, Mark, how many times you've visited Northern Ireland, how many times you've gone across the border, spoke to the community and seen the real impact of the Troubles on what is a very scarred part of our history.
I do believe, Mark, you have family background from Donegal,
yeah,
am I right?
My grandfather was a TD for Donegal. The issue is we are being told that we cannot leave the European Union in an amicable way with an agreement unless we agree to Northern Ireland staying within the EU's single market and a vast number of laws for Northern Ireland being made by the European Union, with no one in Northern Ireland having a democratic say in that. And in addition, the United Kingdom as a whole not being allowed to leave the customs union, not being able to trade freely with other countries in the world without the European Union's permission. That is just not acceptable.
No,
you
can't just leave something you can't just leave agreement unilaterally without discussing it. And no one is saying Northern Ireland is remaining. Let's be very, very clear what the withdrawal agreement actually says about the situation on the island of Ireland. The ideal situation is once the withdrawal agreement, if it is to pass, or an withdrawal agreement passes, is that we immediately start the negotiation of a free trade, customs and regulatory arrangement. That means that there is no return to a hardening of the border on the island of Ireland, and that we can maintain the closest possible relationship.
After that, we will look at the technological solutions.
But in order to do that, Mark, we have to pass the withdrawal agreement, because we can't simply say the good wishes that you refer to.
Okay,
no, we do need a legally binding treaty that looks after the orderly withdrawal of the...
Okay, Neil, I'm just conscious that Mark is at a disadvantage here. So, Mark, do you want to respond to that, please?
I just wanted to say that Article 50 of the European Union says that indeed we can leave without a withdrawal agreement. It gives 2 years to seek to negotiate that, and also in the context of what the future relationship will be. And if that's not agreed within 2 years, then we leave without a deal. We're not liable to pay money, and the situation will be, much less good than it could be.
And we don't receive the returns on those payments either. You don't get the CAN funding or the Horizon 2020 or the Erasmus.
Can I ask you, Mark Reckless, you'd be reasonably happy with a no-deal exit, would you?
I mean, I would prefer to see a negotiated outcome, but for me, I mean, leaving with no deal is not something that is the deal breaker for me. I mean, the most important thing for me, what I've campaigned for throughout my time in politics, is for the UK to leave the European Union, and that's what I want to see. It would be better to do it with a deal, but if the European Union says we won't agree the sort of free trade deal we've got with Canada, with the UK, unless you agree to Northern Ireland staying within our regulatory ambit within the EU single market and say that you can't leave the customs union without our permission, well, that's just not acceptable to the British Parliament. So that implies deal. It's not too late for you and Ireland to think again and for us to deal with these issues in the discussions in the future relationship rather than acting as Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney have in the negotiating process so far, which has led to this vote tonight.
Mark, John McGrain from the British-Irish Chamber of Commerce wants to put something to you.
My organisation represents businesses across the UK and Ireland and employers that employ over 2 million people. Like, your arguments in as much as the idea of it would be better off, the UK would be better off with no deal. I mean, the withdrawal agreement is the ticket on the table that allows British businesses to be part of a process that, first of all, gives a transition period of up to 4 years at the present time. That could be even extended politically, and over that transition period enable the discussion by British public representatives on behalf of their employer and citizen constituents, the length and breadth of the UK, to hammer out a trade deal that gives the UK the best of all worlds. And I'm bemused at the notion that the option is only no deal or get rid of the backstop. The backstop is there, as I understand it politically, on the until and when basis. And meantime, the avoidance of the backstop, which everybody right up to the EU yesterday has said they want to avoid, allows people to craft a deal that's better for everybody, and not least your constituents and employers and investors in future employment in your constituency.
Well, what the problem at the moment is that the legal text means we can't leave the backstop without the EU's permission. A regulatory boundary is put within the United Kingdom, down the Irish Sea, and the UK as a whole can't leave the customs union without the EU's permission. And you say there'll be transition for up to 4 years, but in that transition, we don't get a vote, we don't get a say, we're still paying in. We should have been negotiating these things long ago.
And the employers in your constituency have access to all the benefits of trade across a 500 million consumer EU market, the biggest trading bloc in the world.
We voted to leave the European Union in a sovereign decision in a referendum of the United Kingdom. And I think there is growing frustration, and in many quarters now, I think, anger about the extent to which this is being frustrated, and so many people are trying to stop that happening and not recognising the legitimacy of that democratic
respects the right to leave and enables the maximum benefits until people leave on agreed terms.
It says that if we sign that, Northern Ireland stays in the EU single market, UK stays in the
Mark,
EU customs union.
You're grossly misrepresenting the situation. It doesn't say Northern Ireland stays in the single market. It says that the United Kingdom and the European Union will negotiate a future relationship that will mean that there is no need for the backstop ever to come in. We don't want the backstop. It's there as a last case insurance policy. It covers things to protect the Good Friday Agreement. You can't just keep saying this is a sovereign decision and we're going to walk away and so be it. The United Kingdom have responsibilities. Take responsibility for your decision. Negotiate, protect the Good Friday Agreement and protect the livelihoods of your constituents in Wales and the whole of the United Kingdom. You can't just dismiss this and try and blame it on our Taoiseach.
The same to you, because it is your insistence on the backstop. And
it's our insistence to protect
to
a 20-year-old internationally recognised peace treaty. You must acknowledge that, Mark. If you acknowledge that, come on now.
I would like to keep an open border in Northern Ireland. It requires goodwill and negotiation as
and
part
legal
of the future
guarantees.
On both sides. It cannot be done through blackmailing the United Kingdom as part of a withdrawal agreement that we will not be allowed to leave the customs union and Northern Ireland won't be allowed to leave the single market unless the EU gives us permission. We have a process in Article 50. We get 2 years to negotiate. If an agreement isn't made, we leave without a deal. I don't want that to happen, but it's the insistence on the backstop that is pushing that, and why twice as many British MPs have voted against this withdrawal agreement as voted for it. We want to have that open border to protect the Good Friday Agreement. We need you to drop the backstop and put those into the future relationship and a goodwill conversation,
where's
negotiation.
I just want to ask Mark in relation to the other amendment that was voted on in the House of Commons this evening, relating directly to the backstop. There was very little support for that amendment. Just 24 MPs supported it.
If the backstop is such a crucial issue,
the one big block in resolution of this, why was it such a damp squib when the it was put to the House of Commons?
Well, it was moved by a particular sort of member of Parliament, and I think there were other amendments that would have attracted much wider support because they would have shown the degree to which the withdrawal agreement might be acceptable without the backstop, but the Speaker chose not to call those. I mean, I think if you look at what else is in the withdrawal agreement, and arrangements on citizens' rights, of course, for Irish citizens, you already have the right to work and reside in the UK under separate arrangements. But for other EU citizens, it guarantees those rights. And actually, you know, we are in the UK willing to pay a certain degree of money to maintain amicable relations. And, you know, if we have a period of transition, that is not what the Brexit bill is.
It's not some payment to maintain amicable relations. It's to see off commitments to payments under the European budget, payments that the United Kingdom received quite lucrative returns on in the CAP, Horizon 2020, Interreg, Peace Programme in Northern Ireland, Erasmus+. It's not like it's some sweetener of a reparation.
And we paid in £20 billion a year, of which we've got barely half back, and the EU's
done. How much have you received then through the 70 trade deals that you've got with non-EU countries, your access to the single market, your access to everything that goes in? It's as if you're saying that the EU only have the United Kingdom in it because you pay money in. That is a gross misrepresentation.
Take the example of the beef sector. We have tariffs of about 40% on beef coming from outside the European Union. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, we have to buy Irish beef rather than cheaper beef of equally good quality.
Australia or Argentina.
Why is it in the interest of the British consumer to be forced to pay that? Why should we have our market protected so that we're unable to trade freely with the rest of the world when we have a massive trade deficit with the European Union? We have to make up with the rest of the world. We'd like to trade freely with the whole world and not have these
The biggest sector of the UK economy is the services economy, and all of those services are sold across 500 million consumers because of membership of the EU. That falls away on the 29th of March.
Compared to goods, the single market is very undeveloped in services, and in terms of external trade deals, the EU has done very little to open up overseas markets.
In Japan this year, 80% of the British motor industry exports its product to the EU, so it's good as well.
Lots of countries would like to deal with us if we get rid of tariffs on agriculture and food in return for their opening their markets to our services. So that's why it's a free trading
global nation.
Gentlemen, I just want Rose has been trying to get in for some time. Rose, do you want to make a point to Mark?
Oh, well, I am reluctant in one sense to get into this conversation because I think it's absolutely absurd. I mean, the total disregard for the Good Friday Agreement and what it's there for to protect, and the fact that it's an international legally binding agreement, I think is reckless in the extreme, and to come now and say, well, everything will be fine if we just drop the backstop, I think just doesn't make any sense whatsoever and is representative of nobody. I mean, this is a British mess. This is a British mess that they have to take responsibility for.
I hate, though, when we get into these things that it almost sounds like, you know, that this is all to do with terrorism or even just to do with economics, like as if we're all going to go and dig up the guns and, you know, return to some horrible, troubled history. I don't even, you know, it's about people who get up in the morning and go to work. You know, I'm sure if Mark, I don't know, Mark, if your granddad is still alive, but at some point in his life, he will have been in Alton Galvin Hospital. Mm. You know, it's just not simple. It's like if I said to you in the morning that you weren't allowed to travel between Kent and Surrey. It doesn't make sense in this country to, you know, block one part off from the other. That's what we're dealing with.
But if we go into a period of transition, then that won't happen and we can negotiate.
But have a bit of faith in your ability to negotiate a trade deal.
Without the withdrawal agreement.
Well, and you, France. But you cannot say in advance that we're not allowed to leave the common market. Northern Ireland has to be kept in the single market, even as the Britain leaves, because Parliament votes that down by more than 2-1, whereas actually if we have a negotiation about the future relationship, we will keep an open border, we will have sensible negotiations and goodwill on both sides. And is this attempt in advance to put in this backstop, which should be properly negotiated as part of the future relationship, which is leading to the withdrawal agreement being voted down?
James Lawless.
Yeah, Mark, I was trying to understand your economic arguments as well. I mean, we've heard this question on the Good Friday Agreement, and I echo what other panellists have said on that. But you mean you're talking about the economic benefits being the potential to buy cheaper beef of potentially dubious quality from the other side of the world. What about the loss to the City of London? I mean, we had commentators out this morning. We had the chief executive of one of the key finance associations talking about 10% contraction. He said, regrettably, from his point of view, and presume your point of view, the City of London will never be again as a finance hub of the world. Ireland, thanks to your, what you've advocated for, Ireland will now be the only English-speaking country in the EU. Ireland will be the only common law country in the EU. The Bar of Ireland are active on a recruitment drive to attract litigation to Ireland as the common law hub of Europe. And you've made a very deliberate decision to walk away from all these opportunities. You know, I mean, there's very few silver linings for Ireland, but, you know, if I can say that, might be one of them. But I suppose on the economic arguments, I said the Good Friday Agreement, the international connotations and we talked about, but it's very difficult to understand, you know, for the potential promise that you maybe you can buy cheap beef from the other side of the world rather than buying good quality beef from your neighbour. You know, it's just very hard to stack up, particularly for a Donegal man.
Why can't we just compete on a level playing field where we're not made to pay 40% more for buying beef from elsewhere than we are from Ireland? I mean, that's all I'm saying. I'm sure we still will.
Well, that takes the British beef.
Absolutely.
The City of London is a global centre, and the European Union, for regulatory reasons, a small amount of business.
So why is everybody fleeing? Why are they going to Frankfurt? Why are they going to Strasbourg? Why are they going to Paris? You know, this was Project Fear before the referendum. Project Fear has come to pass. How many will fly to capital? Will fly to jobs?
That's not true. Project Fear said there was going to be a sort of 2 million increase in unemployment and an immediate recession. And I think numbers were put around of 20,000, 30,000, 50,000.
How many jobs have left the City of London in the last 2 years?
So far, identifiably, I think between 2,000 and 3,000, nothing like the 20,000, 30,000, 50,000 that was suggested before.
Okay. Mark Reckless, I'm going to have to move on and take a break. I do appreciate you joining us with that view and holding your own. But it was, I think, 5-1 there. We will no doubt be talking again on this as this story rolls on and on. But there, we will take a break.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. You're listening to The Late Debate with Katie Hannan. And in studio with me, we have Deputy James Lawless of Fianna Fáil, Senator Neil Richmond of Fine Gael, Senator Rose Conway-Walsh of Sinn Féin, John McGrain, the Director General of the British Irish Chamber of Commerce, and Niamh Lyons, Political Editor of the Times Ireland Edition. We're getting a lot of texts. There's been a big reaction to our Brexit discussion tonight, a big night, of course, a red letter day for the UK. My sister in England, this is from Angela, my sister in England told me that most of her Leave voting neighbours would now vote Remain but won't advertise it because of being called traitors. I wonder if that really is the case. Why is it that the EU can't take no for an answer? Says Joe in Wexford. It was the same in Ireland and Denmark. Where's the democracy? We have another one about Theresa May here. May has offered no real leadership. She has tried to keep everyone happy but kept nobody happy. She stands for nothing, made bad decisions and should go. Hi, I was sorry when the UK voted to leave Europe and believed it was bad for everyone in Europe and Ireland and the UK. But after all of this messing around, I'm happy to see the back of them, says Bernard. And finally, we have, they voted to leave. Let them leave with no deal. They are a proud people. Remember the Black Knight episode from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Okay, we will move on now, because while the House of Commons was tearing itself apart today, the focus for Irish politicians was on no deal contingency planning. The Taoiseach set out the current state of play in four key areas, including health.
When it comes to medicines, a plan has been put in place. A working group has been meeting every week now for nearly 2 years, and they've identified a watch list of about 24 medicines that we would be most concerned about. As you know, between about 60 and 70% of medicines either transit the UK or come from the UK.
But has enough been done? Well, it's hard to say when the government has been so secretive, say the opposition.
The government has treated the Dáil and the public shabbily and badly when it comes to sharing its plans in the event of a no-deal Brexit. I think you should treat the Oireachtas and indeed the public with greater respect.
People right across the island of Ireland, but people in my constituency where I travelled the border twice to get down here today, want to know what their future holds in store.
Niamh, you were following the story today. Yeah. You were at the press conference earlier this evening. Did you get the sense that we have a lot done, that we are in a good shape for this?
It's funny because I suppose we are very reliant on, more so than Britain, we can rely on our EU colleagues to kind of give us a dig out. Like I saw the British health minister recently saying that he had become the biggest purchaser of refrigerators globally. And this is because they have to start stockpiling now. They could be cut off. They also have an agreement in place with France where a particular type of drug that can't be refrigerated and has to be used straight away will be kind of flown in on a jet. We don't necessarily have to do that. And in fact, today, Simon Harris appealed to people, pharmacies and hospitals, not to stockpile their medication because that could actually cause a supply chain issue. So of the 4,000 different licensed medications in this country, about 24 of them, as the Taoiseach said there, have been put on a watch list. The other issues, though, that were quite interesting that came up at Cabinet today, the common travel area, which is obviously long predates the European Union, because it was almost kind of a gentleman's agreement, because it now has to be kind of formally underpinned once Britain leaves. So we will have to have a bilateral agreement on that. That's in the eventuality of a no deal. The other issue that came up today as well was in relation to transport chain. Ross very much saying that the aviation chaos that had been flagged is not expected now. The EU have helped us and done a lot of the heavy lifting there. But he said he couldn't give the same guarantees for the haulage industry. No matter what, there is going to be difficulties in that regard. I was asking him whether we were actually going to carry out some of the same exercises as we've seen in Britain in terms of the backlog or what would happen, because I'm sure people remember when Storm Diana hit earlier this year, and it didn't even hit as strongly as it was supposed to. There was tailbacks on the M1 up as far as the Balbriggan exit. So, you know, sometimes even a drop of rain in this country can cause chaos. And as we know, you know, the port tunnel closes and the whole city becomes a car park. So those type of issues are kind of what they're covering week to week. It still has to be said, though, you know, when they released their contingency plan just there before Christmas, it is more like a sort of a schedule of the worst things that can possibly happen rather than an actual plan. I mean, Cabinet are sort of chipping away now. We will see an omnibus bill being drafted and coming before the Houses by February 22nd, but this government is still very much grappling with the response.
Yeah, Rose.
Yeah, I mean, the 17 areas that are being looked at and that legislation is going to be tabled on, but that legislation is not going to be tabled until the 20th of February, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's just going to give us a very, very short time. And we believe that the time is too short for us to be able to scrutinise all that legislation to get the best legislation forward. And that would suggest to us that the government isn't prepared and isn't, you know, is leading us to believe that they're prepared, but I don't believe that they're prepared enough. And there's a huge insecurity out there across businesses and a huge vulnerability. And I think that needs to be addressed very quickly.
James Micheál Martin there in our clip saying people have been treated shabbily. We're not being told what's going on. We've been kept in the dark. Do you think that, or do we have to appreciate that we can't really, you know, put this out into the public domain, that it could be counterproductive? Would you not accept that?
Yeah, sure. Look, I was in the Dáil today when Micheál raised these issues, and of course he raised them in recent interviews over the break as well. I think the government published its no-deal paper on the 19th of December, just coming, you know, just before Christmas. You know, there's been the debate, I think, starts tomorrow. There was talk initially of 5 minutes per spokesperson, 5 minutes per party. You know, that was kind of dismissed. A bit of a row broke out, rightly so, in the Dáil about that, because, you know, something is significant as this, getting 5 minutes per, you know, Fianna Fáil 45 TDs might get 5 minutes to actually make its contribution. Look, there's certainly gaps, I would say, in the strategy. I don't want to be overly pernickety about it. You know, there are, you know, things like the 600 customs officers, I think 200 have been hired compared to 1,000, I think, that the Dutch government have hired. There's certainly, there's holes there. My own view, you know, I think it's common sense. You hope for the best, but you plan for the worst. You know, we don't want to see a scenario, you know, David Cameron didn't plan for the referendum failing. You know, he walked out the door the next day. I think the American establishment didn't plan on President Trump getting elected, but he did. Is an ordeal Brexit going to happen? Who knows? So look, certainly we hope the government are doing all they can. We want to play. I mean, we are being mature, and we're in terms of the confidence supply, we agreed for, you know, the greater good. It's not easy for position for us to be in, but we have said, look, we're going to stand back and we're going to allow for this year, for another of the budget because of the situation they're in. I think that compares very favourably with the pandemonium we're seeing in Westminster.
Okay, let me just put a couple of those points to Neil Richmond. There, the Rose's point that are we leaving it go too late? This could be very significant legislation, and we're being asked. I think February 26th is actually the date that it's going to be produced, and it has to get through by March 14th is the date I have from Simon Coveney's statement today. And also just that idea that is the government taking it seriously in terms of the really genuinely thinking this is a real possibility now that is about to maybe about to befall us?
Is the government taking it serious? You better believe it. The first Brexit preparedness meeting happened in December 2014, 2 years before the referendum even took place. A number of issues raised there, and I'll just try and deal with each of them individually. And very, very quickly. In relation to the timing of the legislation, that's very key. If you start doing this too early, it's the same way Sinn Féin keep asking us to request state aid for the European Commission. We can't do that until the crash out actually happens. You can't do that too early. So it is timing that we never actually want this legislation to have to come in place. Doing it too early takes away resources and so much else. It's time there deliberately, one, to get the legislation drafted and through, and two, to do it so we're actually close to the no-deal scenario.
Is that the same with like hiring people for the customs and all that? You don't want to spend money that may not
be... Well, we initially said that we'd hire the initial 200 in this period and bring it up to 600 in the transition period. Comparing us with the Netherlands is unhelpful because the Port of Rotterdam is the gateway to the entire continent of Europe. It's not comparable to Rosslare, to be fair. We've had over 15 Brexit...
Or Fines or any other ports that might have to...
Yeah, indeed.
I just gave
one example there. And then the final point in relation to...
Very quickly, Neil, because I want to get John...
Myself and John are on the Brexit Stakeholders Forum. We've met over 15 times. The outreach that we've done with civic society and with sectoral has been absolutely massive. The engagement on the Getting Brexit Ready campaign is at multiples compared to what we've seen in the UK. The government is taking this serious, and we will work with every party to solve what will be a national emergency if it comes
to
that.
Katie, the government is doing what it can, and from a British Irish Chamber point of view, we work very closely with government and public officials on the preparations piece. There is no preparation plan that could take on the magnitude of what could potentially happen here on the 29th of March.
Can we actually really prepare for this?
So we have to be realistic about this. And bear in mind, Brexit's already happening for key industries like food. Major Irish food producers and people right down to Farmgate who supply them are already suffering the impositions by British retailers who are saying, we're not waiting until the end of March. We need you to rent warehousing, buffer stocks, chill stocks. All of the operational stuff is already happening. The only form of real preparation for avoidance of the worst case is the withdrawal agreement to be accepted by our friends across the water, and all of our efforts are on helping those people to understand that that is the way to enter a transition agreement, which gives you up to 4 years to plan for our friends leaving, which they're entitled to do, but we need time to prepare for that.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Just a few of tomorrow's headlines. The Irish Examiner have gone with Eve of Destruction over a photo of Theresa May there. A complete humiliation, says the Daily Telegraph. May's Brexit deal crushed by Commons, says the Financial Times. And the Guardian goes with May suffers historic defeat as Tories turn against her. And that's it. Tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. And Andrew Kane was on sound. And now it's over to Cathal Murray on Late Debate.